Thanks, Emer. Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, plenty to go round. The department tells farmers to share their way out of fodder shortages. Asian fusion, Eastern treatments at Easter for spring lamb. A shaggy dog story stuck between a bale and a hard place. Well, in a very novel turn of events, it didn't rain last night, at least where I was anyway, or very, very little it would seem. Because, well, at this stage I think you'll have figured out there are very few farmers not having an absolutely horrendous time of it at the moment, as the weather continues to be appalling. But sheep farmers, while getting no less wet than everyone else, are enjoying a price spike that has been in part fuelled by the end of Ramadan and its festival, Eid al-Fitr, falling so close now to Easter Sunday. So the demand for lamb, or hogget, year-old lamb, is absolutely through the roof. So let us begin this morning with a good news story in the Wicklow Hills. High on the hills that the M11 motorway snakes through outside Wicklow town, you'll see the bright yellow remnants of forage rape that Tommy Delahunt's sheep have been grazing. The hoggets that Tommy and his brother are bringing off the hill before they go to the factory are worth about 25% more to them than this time last year.
Well, you have the black. The black or the Suffolk. Mm-hmm. There's a Lanark in there with the multicolored. You see the black and white face and a small bit of a horn. Dare I say, my father would cut my head off. He just didn't like horny sheep, as we call it in the trade.
Tommy doesn't breed his own lambs. He buys in the autumn, fattens in the winter on catch crops like the rape that he has grown over the summer, and then sells in the spring. So his flock is a very mixed bag of breeds.
You have the one with the wool on the haste, the Dorset sheep. You see the one with the wool on the head. There's all different breeds.
Are these all at around about the same age then? Because there's a lot of difference in the carcass weight from one animal to the next.
There is a lot of difference there, but normally we grade them out. Those sheep there that you're looking at there are 44 to 46 kilos. They're very close to slaughter weight.
Being factory ready now is a great piece of timing for Tommy. Easter Sunday and Eid al-Fitr, the festival that marks the end of Ramadan, will this year fall within a fortnight of each other.
Well, you would gear towards Easter or Ramadan in your psyche or in your mindset. And they know, the trade know, they boost the price, do you know what I mean, to entice you to sell at that time.
About 10 years or so ago, I saw figures from within the meat industry which suggested that amongst Irish people, 95% of them, that was the actual figure, 95% of them never ate lamb, never went anywhere near it. Has the changing cultural and religious profile around Europe of more Muslims helped your business?
Seemingly so. Seemingly that would be the case, yeah. And it's very much so at the moment anyway. There's a huge demand there. Huge demand. You know, when you take that 85% going out, it's either through carcass farm or live trade. A big majority of that's going to that market. Mm. It's good to see it.
Over 80% of the sheep that are produced in Ireland are exported. So that boon in price this year is determined more by international events than the coincidence of two religious festivals almost overlapping.
The Houthis say their attacks on commercial shipping in the Red Sea will continue until Israel stops its attacks on Gaza.
Now, we are in a red zone here in the Red Sea. The Houthis could attack at any moment.
With the Red Sea now part of a wider set of...
Houthi rebel interference with shipping in the Red Sea, which they have claimed is being done out of solidarity with the Palestinian people, has interrupted the best-laid plans of Brexit Britain to source lamb from its Commonwealth partners instead of Europe.
Well, the result of the disruption has increased the cost of consumer goods, including food items which are eaten during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, such as...
How much of this job is looking at the calendar a year out and trying to be strategic about it? Or are you always just going to be subject to events, dear boy?
I think that's about the size of it. That we like to think... Well, we do have a handle on it in the sense that what we grow to feed the crop, what we grow to feed the sheep, and what cost we want to pay for sheep coming in. So yeah, we do have a hand lot, but the other end of it is it's supply and demand. An event, whoever thought an event in the Suez Canal was going to affect price? You couldn't. I couldn't predict that. You know, really, I couldn't predict that. And like the French and the Spanish farmer last year, with the price of barley where I went to, they couldn't afford to feed their animals, so they sold. So they're relying on more stock coming from Ireland or somewhere else to fill that market. So that's another. Did I predict that? I couldn't predict that. No, certainly not.
Did anybody?
I often ask that question, and I ask the smarter minds than me to see if they knew, and they say they don't know.
So you are able to make hay while the sun shines in 2024?
You are, yes.
But how much compensating do you have to do for what happened last year?
Well, we were... I don't know how they call it, luck or whatever, but the December period last year, I had an awful lot of sheep on hand, and my father, who's since passed, was giving out to me. He said, you've too many sheep, you've too many sheep. And he was right, like, we had an awful lot of stock on hand because the season was good for growing. I predicted I was going to need a certain amount of stock. We had an awful lot of stock on hand, made a decision over Christmas. We're selling a volume of these sheep. Little did I know what was coming down the track at that period. So, like, you can get stuck in any situation, like, you know what I mean? You can have the best will in the world and things happen outside of your parameters.
Well, absolutely. I mean, how do you make any predictions about the weather?
You just can't. You just can't. This year you seem to be day to day, week to week, and it seems to be more wet than dry, unfortunately.
But here, on this day, in this yard, you're a good news story in farming. I mean, you're looking at selling into a market with a massively inflated price, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. We've never seen the like of it. I've asked older and people, have they ever seen it? And they've gone to fairs and marts for years and years and years. They said they never, ever seen what happened this year. It's took everybody by surprise.
Tommy Delahunt there in Wicklow, making hay while the sun shines, or rather fattening sheep while the rain still pours. Now, this almost overlap of Easter and Eid al-Fitr got me thinking about what else is being done with lamb this weekend, aside from just serving it up with a bit of mint jelly. So I'm joined in studio, I'm glad to say, by Wasim Salim of the award-winning Data Restaurants, who continues to be inspired by his late grandmother's cooking and how she might prepare lamb for Eid. Good morning, Wasim. You're very welcome to the studio.
Good morning, Philip. Thanks for having me.
Are many of your customers choosing lamb?
Average 40%.
Really?
Yeah.
Because you heard what I was saying there to Tommy about nationally, it's really only people over the age of 60 who are still eating lamb, and in increasingly small numbers.
No, I'd say every age with us, even... last night we've seen the orders, coconut lamb, which is, you know, mainly for the kids. Mm-hmm. But then we do many other dishes like lamb and spinach, lamb karahi dish, lamb jalfrezi.
How important is it, do you think, in this popularity of lamb to not serve it on the bone?
Very important. But yet we do a dish called lamb karahi, and that's cooked on the bone. It's slow cooked, and people who knows the flavors of cooked on the bone will definitely go for that.
Is this lamb karahi your grandmother's dish?
Correct.
Okay, talk to me about it. What's special?
It's just simple way of cooking by herself. But then there is a, you know, she adds she cook it with the butter, which is butter ghee, we call it.
Mm-hmm. And that's clarified, like, butter, yeah.
Purified butter. And then it's cooked for 2 to 3 hours on the bone in a pot.
And what's the marinade?
This is basically just the simple recipe of the karahi dish with the ginger and garlic paste and tomatoes, onions, and green chilies and turmeric powder. And it's basically, if you know how to cook it, That's what makes the difference.
Okay. And how long do you leave it marinating in the garlic paste?
For this one, you don't have to leave it for marination. But for the lamb leg, for to cook it into the oven, you have to leave it for basically 24 hours.
Okay. So time is, as always, the other ingredient.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah, yeah.
You use papaya in a very interesting way.
Yes, correct. So papaya is basically used in for barbecue marinations. And if you cook something like leg of lamb on, you know, as Irish tradition, but to make it even softer. And it's used as meat, you know, people use meat tenderizer, but we use papaya.
Really? That yes. is fascinating. I've never yeah. heard of it being used in that way before.
Yeah, it's raw papaya.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're an amazing success story. It
Thank
was
you.
The late 90s, a modest takeaway in Bray. And how many restaurants now?
We have four restaurants and a takeaway works still there in Bray. So we started back in 1999 by my uncle. And
having arrived from Pakistan when?
Well, in the early 90s.
Okay.
And worked in Dublin, George Street as a head chef in an Indian restaurant. And... but, you know, when he gets his, you know, he always liked to open his own. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. he opened in Bray in 1999. And that's where it all started.
And his mother, your grandmother, really sounds like the kind of the key inspiration
Absolutely.
For so many of the dishes.
Yes. Yeah. So the especially, you know, well, he actually started cooking by, you know, by... by looking at her the way she used to cook. Uh-huh. So, and like many other family members in the family, you know, inspired by her, including myself, my wife, my mother and my aunt, everybody like so. But nobody cooks like her.
Did she know? Does she know how important she has been to the success of the business here?
Well, she is. She kind of know and that she does the best cooking, but you know, obviously she know in you know in deep in her that she's an inspiration to us. But we always say that to her that nobody can cook like you, grandmother. So, and she's here twice. She lived here for 3 months in one occasion and 3 months when my uncle opened his own business, and she was over the moon.
Tell me about the farm and tell me about the kitchen. Was it Faisalabad?
Faisalabad, yeah. Basically, I was very young when all these we were allowed to have you know cattle and mm-hmm. buffaloes and sheep and the goats in the back of our you know gardens.
Yeah.
And that's where so milk the cows and you know having your own back garden with the with vegetables in it and you know feeding your own animals.
It was all there
it
outside
was all
the back
there.
Door.
Yeah.
Now, listening to Tommy Delahunt must be a kind of an awkward experience for you because while he is making hay while the sun shines and making a bit of a killing, the cost to you must have gone through the roof, has it?
It has. And to be honest, the supply is tough as well these days with all the, you know, with our supplier anyway. He's having difficulties to get the lamb on time, but he's doing his best and he's getting what we need. But it normally we get a couple of deliveries or three times, but now he's probably have to give us on daily basis for the last few weeks.
I'm hearing kind of stratospheric prices for a leg of spring lamb now. Like €120.
Yes, crazy. Yeah.
Is that what you're paying?
That's correct. Yeah. And coming to spring lamb will be the same, you know, and they'll be as expensive as it anywhere.
Okay. Does that mean that you are tending towards offering hogget or even mutton dishes on the menu, or do you stick with the spring lamb?
Well, spring lamb, you can only get it during the time, during the season, because it's born and around December time, and then it's available for the spring season. An older lamb is available, then that's what we're trying to use. Not as much as haggard, but we prefer lamb.
And is this shortage of supply down, do you think, to the overlap of Easter and the end of Ramadan? Or is it all the other things that Tommy was talking about there, the Suez Canal and global price?
To be honest with you, it's just the time of the year. I think it's not, maybe it's to do with Suez Canal as well, but I can't tell. What I can see, it's happened every year around this time. And, you know, that's the reality of it.
That's the reality of it. Well, you can hardly begrudge people like Tommy or anybody in farming a few extra quid at now, can you?
Well, you know, that's they know their business, and you can't really point fingers at anybody. The supply has to be there. You can charge whatever it costing you to make the fair money. But I would recommend the supply has to be, you know, your supplier has to deliver to their customer.
Yeah.
And demand has to be priority, Ireland first, and then, you know, you can export whatever you like.
Thank you very much for coming in to us this morning and for sharing your grandmother's recipe, which we will also share on our Twitter account. Wasim Salim, thank you very much, as I say. Coming up after
thank
the break, we're going to see what impact the weather is having on those who gathered at Kilkenny Mart to buy or sell this week.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
In case there was any lingering doubt in your mind, Met Éireann confirmed it during the week. Yes, climate change is one of the reasons that we are seeing all of this rain. The El Niño cycle is mixed in there as well, and it will in time cycle out. But in the meantime, the combination of the two is making the waters of the Atlantic warmer than ever recorded, which is putting more moisture in the atmosphere, which is falling in heavier and heavier downpours. Which reminds me, episode 2... Rising Tides Wednesday deals with all of this and how we're going to adapt to ever-increasing amounts of rainfall. But back to Countrywide, RT Radio 1, Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Who in the middle of all of this rain would want to be farming? Well, less and less was the answer I got when I went to Kilkenny Mart on Tuesday.
Hopefully letting cattle out soon, but the weather has been horrible.
Have you had anything out?
No.
At all yet? Nothing.
Definitely not. Definitely not, Philip.
Pat Hutchinson was one of many that I met on Tuesday, who with one eye on the sales ring and the other on the weather forecast, was keeping his hands firmly in his pockets.
The weather dictates, and you have to go with the weather, and that's it. So you have to be philosophical. If it gets you down, you're in trouble, aren't you?
But there must be those days where you say, I think I might just pull the curtains and ignore it all today.
Well, if you have stock, you can't do that because you have to look after them. Some days you would wish it, yes. Yes.
If you're coming here today with an animal that's 6 or 7 weeks old, how much has that cost you?
Between AI, feed, everything, extra feed on the animals, you're talking somewhere between 150, 170.
And what are they going for here, those Friesian bull calves?
Anywhere at the moment from €5 to €50.
Pat Hutchinson was a buyer. The mood amongst sellers, especially those with young bull calves like Friesian or Jerseys that would struggle to put on weight, they knew that they were there to make a loss.
Can't afford to have them any longer in the yard. It's costing too much between milk replacement and milk. Just move them on, get rid of them. That's the system we're in. No market.
Is it sustainable to keep on doing this year after year and expecting a different result?
No, but how do you get the cows back in milking?
There's an understandable consumer desire to minimise the number of really young calves being brought to mart. The creameries want their farmers to hold on to those calves for longer, and the calves on sale this week were older than a year ago. But looking at mounting slurry, dwindling fodder and rising costs, farmers like this man now feel that the expansion of the dairy industry has come at a cost to him while profiting shareholders.
Many, 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 many,
So if the creamers and the other co-ops want to pay for it or subsidise it to be a help, but are they willing to?
No, and they probably won't want to pass that cost on to the consumer.
No, they won't. But like with the expansion and the whole lot, the expansion of the dairy industry has led to expansion of the slurry and storage. But the co-ops haven't done a whole heap about that for the farmer. The dairy industry has doubled, but the production of slurry in the farmyard has doubled.
Do you feel that you're in the business of supplying those processors, those multinational corporations, with the raw material, come what may, at whatever cost to you? They just need their raw material going in that factory gate.
Yes, they just want milk. That's all they want. You know, so they are creaming it, basically. Like, you see the profits. They'll say they're high-end markets. Don't see any of them really losing money on any of them, but they'll say that's the game we're in. That's the cost of producing milk.
But it's not a sustainable practice if you're not looking after your primary producer.
Nope, that's why they're getting less. That's why more dairy farmers, you'll see, between the exit scheme, triumvirate scheme, big man is probably getting bigger and the small man is getting out.
Back at the ring, these two men told me about the calves that would inevitably go unsold at the end of the day.
Well, half the time you get a Jersey calf or nothing, take them off out of the place. Because a lot of the big outfits, with disease and all the rest, if that calf goes out of the property in the morning, they don't want to come back. Because it's mixing with other calves here, so then God knows what it brings home with it. So if you don't make anything in the ring, you could get a phone call from the mart. There's 10 calves here, nobody wants them. Do you want them?
Does that happen often, does it?
Not time.
And do you take them, or are they more trouble than they're worth?
Some people will. I wouldn't, because you'd probably lose half of them, wouldn't you? You'd lose half of them.
Well, anybody would say it costs at least the same, if not more, to rear the small, poor calf than the good one. So, I mean, different, you're paying more, for the good one there you buy, but he'll always be the good one.
So it's a completely false economy buying something for 20, 30 euro and thinking that you're getting a good price.
Bit dodgy, I'd say, yeah.
It tells its own story that the happiest man I met in Kilkenny Mart on Tuesday was the man with no animals on his farm and no intention of buying any.
I'm very happy altogether. Yeah.
And will you get back in when the weather improves?
No, this year, with my age and everything else, I'll buy something older, you know.
Okay.
Yeah,
something that's a little bit less work?
Something a bit less work, yeah.
Will you wait until the forecast improves before doing that?
I will, because I'll want to put them out on grass, and I don't want them to plough the place. I wish they would.
Isn't it mad, though? It's the man who's here who has no stock, zero stock, who's probably doing better than anybody else.
Well, I think so anyway. But maybe the person with the stock, he won't agree with me.
Some of the voices at Kilkenny Mart on Tuesday. Now, the National Fodder and Food Security Committee met yesterday as a response to the pressures that the weather is placing on farmers. Its chairperson is Mike McGann. He joins us now. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Philip.
Can you give us a sense of what you heard at this meeting yesterday about the difficulties that farms are in?
Yeah, with a wide range of stakeholders, that's the strength of the group is the fact that virtually all elements of the industry are represented around the table, which means that you get a comprehensive picture of what's out there, what's happening around the country. I suppose it could be broken into, let's sort of break it into three sections, dairy farming, livestock farming and tillage. Dairy farmers are under pressure they've evolved a system over the years that you get out to grass when the cows calve and you've got some fertilizer out at that stage. They went indoors a month earlier. They're now indoors a month later, so invariably that has put pressure on their silage stocks and they haven't got out fertilizer. So that's one group, and they are obviously the ones that are at the coalface with a lot of animals, and they're feeling pressurized, and they have a lot of stress in their lives, never mind everything else. So that's one group. The livestock farmers, a little bit less of an issue with fodder. They don't appear to be as tight, and the figures indicate that. I think the tillage farmers are the ones that we really need. They're silently suffering because they don't have the animals, so there's not as much attention being drawn to them. But economically, they're in a really bad way. They haven't been able to look after, haven't been able to sow as much crops as they would normally. They haven't been able to, you know, apply the normal husbandry to those crops. Things are looking very, very bad for them.
Indeed, we were talking to a tillage farmer last week, and the real fear for them now is that they will go from the situation of deluge to, by maybe the end of May, being in a drought situation, and yields will be down hugely. But can we just come back to dairy and livestock for a second? Chagas' analysis is that there is enough fodder in the country if everyone shares what it is that they have. But why, Mike, would anyone not want to hold on to what they have now if there is no end in sight to this weather?
Yeah, fair question. I suppose we tend to be an optimistic industry, and we tend to believe, look, it can't be always raining. Now, the last month or two has put paid to that theory. But I suppose we also look out for each other, Philip. It's a fair question as to why would somebody share. But there's considerable extra stock of silage around the place. It's probably not in the right, it's not on, in the farms that really need it. But there are also farms that don't have a tradition of maybe selling silage bales or fodder, but have it to spare. And maybe we could, and the good thing about this kind of a forum, this program, is that maybe that farmer now will say, hey, I've got it extra. I'll talk to my farm organization, or I'll talk to my Chagas advisor and make that available. And maybe that's one of the good things that come out of this, that we look out for each other and share. Your question is a fair one, but equally, we are in a situation we don't normally see. We have a model of farming that has evolved over the years that is weather dependent, and the weather is now extreme. We can have another debate on another day as to what's the cause and effect on that side of it, but we have to adjust accordingly, and this is a short-term adjustment to solve the immediate problem.
You heard their voices at Kilkenny Marta, people who are clearly emotionally and physically absolutely exhausted, people that you would be genuinely worried for. The farm organisations yesterday at your meeting were looking for a suspension or a curtailment of farm inspections to alleviate the pressure on those people. Did they explain how they felt that that would help, or is it not just opportunistic?
It's a good observation that what they looked for makes sense. Equally, if there are no less inspections now, does that mean more inspection at another time? But equally, if somebody is under strain and stress, adding an extra layer of worry in having an inspector coming around the place, it's human nature being what it is, it would be better that doesn't happen now. Equally, we understand that we do need to be inspectors, and we do need to ensure that the best possible standards are upheld. But just sympathy to the cause would be helpful. And maybe I'm not saying that there's a blanket prohibition on inspection, but a little bit of common sense around inspection at this time would be helpful.
And how was the suggestion received by the department?
The department are concerned that if they don't comply with European rules and regulations around inspections, that payments are held up. And certainly that would be the last thing we need, because the payments are a crucial part of the farming system. So, but I think they were listening without declaring anything, if that doesn't sound a contradiction.
This is just 1 year, Mike, but the climate modelling is saying that there's more and more of this in store. Now, you heard again one of the people in Kilkenny Mart saying a major rethink is needed. Would you agree?
I think that's a discussion that must be held. If we have a model that presumes a certain date of cows going in and a certain date of cows, excuse me, one second. Sorry, and a certain date for when cows go to grass, and that's going to be affected. We do definitely need to have a rethink. The cold snap in January that we all remember from our youth is gone. The good thing is the grass has grown better over the winter because it has been mild. There is more grass out there on farms, and we can, with a little bit of the people who wouldn't normally do on-off grazing, they should consider it, because if you go out for a few hours a day, they won't do an awful lot of damage on your driest fields. They won't do any on your driest fields, but it gets them out of the yard. It gets them out of your hair. It gets them out of your system for an hour or two. Milk earlier that evening, a bit of excellent advice from Joe Patton. Bring them in, milk them earlier, and just relax for the evening and just try and de-stress on the farm. But to your substantive point on, do we need to change the model? I think we have to have that discussion. Model changing is big. Changing, turning around an entire system of farming in a short term is not an easy thing to do. But it is, if we need to make more fodder, if we need to get tillage farmers to grow crops for us, for other farmers, livestock farmers, we need to look at that model. And maybe that's a solution for them, that if we can contract to buy, for example, maize or whole crop from a tillage farmer and pay him some of that money in advance to make sure that his business survives. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's a good thing to do, and maybe that we do need to look out for another 20% of fodder stocks in the system that we haven't had in the past, and maybe that would be the first step that we should be considering.
All right, a conversation we will continue to have here on Countrywide. Mike McGann, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Well, Easter eggs these days, usually obviously the chocolate variety at this weekend, but in the not too distant past, eggs were stored through Lent for an egg feast on Easter Sunday morning. Try sharing that idea with your kids this weekend. But if you're thinking about having a hen's egg tomorrow morning, remember, each box of eggs has its own story. And down on their 100-acre organic farm in County Tipperary, Ollie and Esther O'Brien produce, grade and sell their own eggs directly into shops under the brand Esther's Eggs. When they met in New York, farming was the last thing on this couple's minds, but they have come back to Ollie's home place, and the egg business has become the mainstay of their farming enterprise. As Hannah Quinn Mulligan discovered when she visited them, Ollie began by introducing her to the 600 hens that make it all possible.
Okay, Hannah, this is our hen shed. You can see all the hens here happy out. Some of them are going in, some of them are going out. You can see here they're not too crowded, they've plenty of space, and that's kind of down to the organic standards, which requires that the birds have 50% more space than a free-range system.
That's a lot, isn't it? 50%?
It's 6 birds per square metre. I think free-range it's 9. When you have a system like that and they have more space, they're less inclined to pick on each other and bully each other because they've more freedom and they're not confined, so they're not stressed. Back in the 80s, this would have been a dairy farm, just a conventional dairy farm, up until the 1987. My dad got cleared out with TB, and I presume maybe he was just sick of dairying at that stage as well, so he decided to get out of dairying. After that, then he got into beef, and he tried a lot of different enterprises, from agritourism to Christmas trees, a bit of forestry and stuff like that. And then in the early 90s, he decided to go organic. So this farm has been organic, fully certified, for just over 30 years now.
Was it a bit very strange, though, for all the neighbours looking across the hedge wondering what on earth is going on over there?
I'd imagine it was. Listen, I was only a young guy back then, so yeah. I didn't really take much notice, and yeah. I was the youngest of 2 older brothers, so I was never going to be the farmer anyway. So it was a case that I didn't really have much interest back then, but it was very different to get into organics back then. But my dad was always one for trying new things, and he didn't shy away from that.
And how did you end up being the farmer then?
I guess I travelled a bit in my 20s, early 20s, mid 20s, and I ended up meeting Esther, my now wife, in New York, and she comes from a farming background in New Zealand. So we both had an interest in, you know, the values of growing up on a farm and stuff like that. And when we started a family, we showed a real interest, and my dad saw that, and he said, yeah, maybe we're potentially the ones to take over the farm in time, and this is where we are now.
Because it isn't a small farm. How big is it in total?
It's about 100 acres. Yeah.
And besides, so you have your organic beef cattle as well, organic eggs, and what else are you doing with the land?
We're trying to diversify a small bit. We've planted, we'll say, maybe about 2.5 acres of mixed orchards, which are apples and nuts, which are cob nuts, which are hazels, and we've got quite a few currants as well, and we're starting off with some raspberries too.
Okay, well, we're gonna step this way because Esther's waiting for us in the packing shed, am I right?
Yes,
saying
the
that?
Packing centre. Yeah.
Hey Esther, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
It's lovely to meet you, thank you very much.
No worries, welcome to our packing centre. I've just been out this morning collecting the eggs. So we usually have around 600 hens. So I bring them in every morning, and I pack them by hand. So this is like my little quiet place. I like to do this for a couple of hours every morning, stamp them by hand, label them by hand. And then once or twice a week, we take a big delivery and we deliver them to local shops in the area, Limerick.
And Ali mentioned that you guys met in New York, which sounds quite glamorous. Did you ever see yourself in an egg packing shop?
No, this is absolutely the last place I wanted to end up. But I love being on the farm now. I grew up on a sheep station, 3,000-acre sheep station in the middle of nowhere in New Zealand. And our nearest neighbour was 10 kilometres away. So I was used to growing up on the farm, but as a teenager, I found it quite lonely and I was keen for the city life. So I went to New York and I met Ollie, and he didn't look like a farmer. So I was just happy with that. So that's
fine. He fooled you essentially.
He did, yeah. And then he got the phone call, like his father was interested in one of the sons helping him out. So we came back, and after a few years, we settled here at the homestead. And I'm really happy that it's organic and that we ended up having a little, you know, piece of paradise.
And in terms then of carving out that paradise, though, we are in the egg packing centre. Everything is white. Everything is very clean. I see there's an egg grading machine over there as well. Is there a lot of red tape involved?
So every 12 weeks, I would go and test for salmonella, test the hen houses. And you just missed James Joy. Big hi out to James, because he listens to the show every week, he said. But he had to run off there, but he was taking a few eggs to get residue testing. So they test to see...
That's the department testing.
Yeah. It's really important to have a good relationship with your inspector, so not be afraid of regulation or inspections, because at the end of the day, you have to work with them. And if you get in touch with them first and find out what you need to do, it really saves you a lot of headache. And we have a great relationship with our inspector, and we'll be sad to see him retire. So we hope we can continue with that.
Has it been difficult, though, the last couple of years?
Yes, it has been. Like the last year, when the prices, our feed costs went up 100%. Also, we had to get organic pullets now. So EU regulations have changed. So the costs in getting pullets have changed as well. It has become more of a challenge. And we're very lucky to have survived that.
What did your parents, I guess, think of the operation, you coming to Ireland and setting up on an organic beef farm?
I suppose, I'm not sure. I suppose they thought it was a bit of a surprise at first that I'd end up... I wanted to be a farmer when I was small. I remember telling my father, and when I was small, women weren't farmers. So I think he kind of poo-pooed that idea, but I'm guessing he's quite happy that I'm probably the only one that's left in farming at the moment. So they've been out a couple of times and they just think the place is amazing, and amazed that it's so small and can still be a farm, because the farms are just huge over there.
This Christmas we're hoping to get to New Zealand. Well, it's booked now, so I suppose we have to go. So Esther's dad is still over in Gisborne. He's retired from farming now, and He wanted us to come over with the kids for Christmas. It'd be nice to be there for Christmas and get a bit of sunshine, hopefully.
Ollie and Esther O'Brien talking to Hannah in Tipperary. Well, right now I am looking at a photo of two very good dogs who live in County Leash. One is Smokey, little black terrier with a foxy face, white bib, two white socks, and the other is Sally, a Wheaton terrier mix. And both would look like butter would not melt in their mouths, but in the past week they have put their owner through the ringer. Spoiler alert! There's a happy ending to this story in case you can't take any more bad news. But I'm joined on the line now by Mark Smith, who got a call from his dad earlier in the week to say that Sally and Smokey were missing. Mark, tell me, Sally in particular means an awful lot to your dad.
She does. She means a lot to all of the family, Philip. She goes everywhere with him. She's his faithful companion, and not just heading to dad, but to all of the grandchildren as well, and particularly to my six-year-old, who would have been quite phobic and anxious of dogs, and her calming presence, I suppose, with the support of my dad, has helped her to overcome that fear. So she means a lot to all of us. Okay.
So the family, neighbours, friends all fanned far and wide trying to find the two errant pups and bring them home again, but it was you who ended up heading in the right direction.
Yes, well, it was. We put the call out on social media on every platform we could find, every road and by lane a leash. And I suppose it was a conversation with my dad. He kind of decided, look, I'm going to have to get the wellies on and get out in the fields, because there'd been no sight of them anywhere. And they traversed a couple of local farms, came across a barn, and thought, let's have a look in here. Maybe this is an adventure they might have gone on. And there were over 200 bales of hay stacked high, almost 3 metres. So he looked through a few of them, called out and heard a little bit of a whimper, and kind of investigated and looked down through a large hole and saw that Smokey had fallen down. So with the assistance of one of his local farmers and a Ukrainian who's staying with my dad, they managed to climb down and to rescue Smokey. But
okay, where was Sally though?
That was the big conundrum. So we'd kind of positive news, but no sign of her. So they searched three times, all 200 stacks, and not a sound was there. So I know in a phone call to my dad, he had kind of really resigned himself that, look, she was probably there, but unfortunately didn't make it. So there was a lot of sadness around. I kind of broke the news to the kids that maybe it wouldn't be good news. Mm-hmm. And just instinct, I suppose, maybe made him think, look, let's have one more final look. And he noticed some straw that looked a little bit disturbed, called out again, and just heard a whimper, and happened to look down, and Sally's a little bigger than Smokey, so she was wedged further down. So he had to call in the troops again, and a local farmer with a load all came and lifted the bales out, and thankfully they were able to make a rescue.
I know how this story ends, and yet I find myself tearing up. Yes. But the little brats, I mean, a teleporter had to be brought in to move all of these bales.
Yes, indeed. And they came out as if nothing had ever happened. Like, what was all the fuss all about? But I think there was a very positive response, even to the local farming community in a local WhatsApp group, had kind of sent lots of messages of congratulations. They were delighted that the dogs are found. And I think similarly on social media, I think everybody these days, there's a lot of negativity, there's a lot of negative news, even for the farming community with everything with the water and the fields. We needed something, some sort of small good news story to hold on to.
Indeed. It was lovely how everybody ended up getting behind it, including President Michael D. Higgins' own dog.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise to see Mishnock's account to call out looking for it, but also to see such a lovely response when the dogs were found. So it was very nice, very positive for everyone involved.
All right, Mark, give a treat of some kind, if you would, on our behalf, please, to both Sally and Smokey. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Phil.
A little good news story. On the countrywide dog hunting team, Amandine Paso Devine plastered the neighbourhood with missing posters. Mark McGrath shouted their names till he was hoarse, but Eileen Heron just sat there because she knew they'd always come home. That's our lot for this week. Sinead Mooney's up after the news at 9 o'clock. Have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.